Now, I must say something here about the inspections. From my point of view, and that's something that we could argue about, the foundation for building a peace movement, of course, is not inspection. That even, hypothetically, if inspections were to show the existence of some weapons of mass destruction, and well, they might, nevertheless, the ability of Iraq to attack, Iraq constituting a threat, after all, there are dozens and dozens of countries with weapons of mass destruction that far exceed what Iraq has, including Pakistan, which has a whole arsenal of thermonuclear weapons and an autocratic, ultra-right-wing government that's being threatened right now by its own pro-Bin Laden fundamentalists. That's a threat. So that even if Iraq were to have these kinds of weapons, and even if the inspections were to demonstrate this, the determination to stop a war should be greater, not less than ever. That nevertheless, we shouldn't get too far ahead of public opinion on this. And we should defend the inspections at this point, because this is what the public of the United States and much of the public of the world is kind of banking on to throttle the drive to war. So we have to see both, in my opinion. I'm going to move along toward the end here. Is this about democracy and human rights? Okay. One could argue that among the various shams that are being, you know, thrown out there for public consumption, this notion that we will restore democracy and human rights to a region of the world that is honeycombed with dictators, etc., is a sham on the first of it. At this very moment, of course, Washington is supporting despotic regimes in Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Colombia, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, El Salvador, Guatemala, on and on and on and on. The United States, on the other hand, is threatening democracy in Venezuela. I expect that we will soon threaten democracy in Ecuador, that if the new Workers' Party government in Brazil is to move toward redistributing wealth in some moderate degree, democracy in Brazil will be threatened, and on and on. And now we see that general strikes have broken out this week. You know, nobody's looking in Peru. And we will begin to see Washington perhaps trying to stem the tide of social change throughout Latin America, which is reeling from the negative impact of the global economy. Further, talk about democracy and human rights is undermined by the fact that not only is repression tolerated all over the world, but repression is growing at home. And not only the U.S. Patriot, USA Patriot Act, which includes locking a U.S. citizen into a military brig in total isolation without access to a lawyer, much less charges, a fundamental upending of the constitutional right to be charged, to have a lawyer, to have a public trial, reports that Bush Ashcroft are ready now to begin military tribunals. 650 people are still sitting in intolerable conditions where Washington will not allow human rights inspection teams in Guantanamo, in eastern Cuba. Watergate criminal Poindexter presides, although Congress the other day refused to fund him, which is good news. But Poindexter presides over this massive total information awareness program to gather every scrap of information on every U.S. citizen and non-citizen living within these borders. And the very latest, which we may not have noticed, but the Bush administration is now preparing a new bill, which they call, quote, a bold, comprehensive sequel to the USA Patriot Act, which will give the government broad, sweeping new powers to increase domestic intelligence gathering, surveillance, and law enforcement prerogatives, and simultaneously decrease judicial review and public access to information. One of the things we could anticipate, by the way, and have to be ready for, is that a tremendously democratic tool has emerged out of this new technology, the email, the internet. And it has proved to be a remarkably effective means of informing and organizing people. A half dozen people, just rank and file folks, got together and formed a group called MoveOn.com, which has had an enormous impact in bringing the truth to people and mobilizing people regarding the threat of war. One of the implications of this proposed new administration regarding public access to information is to try to find the technological means to commit an act of political murder, so to speak, and that is to begin to cut back on the ability of the internet democratically to be a tool in the hands of people organizing in their own interest. As for Iraq's internal policies on this question of democracy, first of all, I think we have to be clear. Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath regime is a military tribal clique which seized power some quarter century ago, and of course, control of oil, seized power from the progressive wing of the Ba'ath Party. It cut itself off from a socialist mainstream in the Ba'ath and brutally crushed the formerly vibrant Iraqi left, torturing and killing scores of communists, socialists, Democrats. While this was happening, there was not a peep of protest from Washington, only a wink, a nod, and quiet satisfaction. Of course, it has now been thoroughly documented by a Senate hearing in 1994 that during the Iran-Iraq War, Washington tilted, quote, tilted to Saddam, providing both material and knowledge for the construction of chemical and biological weapons. It was Washington that set Iraq on that path. With the sure footprints of history as a guide, the objective of conquering Iraq, of killing tens of thousands of civilians, of creating perhaps 900,000 refugees, according to UN estimates, of installing a US military regime, of handpicking Iraqi accomplices who were already involved in negotiating deals with US oil companies to take over Iraqi oil, all this hardly constitutes a commitment to democracy. And with massive casualties predicted, the notion of extending human rights to the long-suffering Iraqi people is cruel and bizarre in the extreme. So, and we'll end on this note, what is behind the motives driven by a coherent, identifiable clique of far-right intellectuals, neoconservatives, militarists, and Sunbelt extractive industry vultures? Oil? Well, all right. Press reports have piled up. For example, Washington Post is way back in September 15th of 2002 that the U.S. is looking to a post-Saddam bonanza by taking control of Iraq's 112 billion barrels of oil, largest known proved reserves in the world, second to Saudi Arabia, and canceling existing oil deals between Iraq, French, Russian, Chinese interests. Bush, Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Rumsfeld, of course, are all well connected to oil. On taking office as vice president, Cheney targeted energy security, and he won't reveal, by the way, who he's been talking to in the energy industry, as a top priority. By 2020, that is not eyesight, but the year 2020, two-thirds of oil imported from the Middle East will be exhausted. Iraq, with its oil, and Saudi Arabia with its oil currently constitute 62% of U.S. energy reserves. In other words, we get 62% of our oil from the Middle East. Yes, the United States is pushing Caspian reserves to tap that, but that's only 22 billion barrels compared to 112 billion barrels held in Iraq. After OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, was formed in the 1970s. Five big oil companies, Exxon, Mobil, Chevron, Shell, British Petroleum, only controlled 4% of oil reserves. Control of Iraq and Iraq's oil reserves already verified by the right-wing Iraqi National Congress, which stands in the wings ready to take over under U.S. military tutelage, that is General Tommy Franks, have said, and I quote, the U.S. will have a big shot at Iraq oil, unquote, with Russia, France, China sidelined, perhaps frozen out, or perhaps given an offer to renegotiate whatever deals they have under the aegis of the United States. The U.S. Energy Department's Oil and Natural Gas Working Group, squired, among other things, by Cheney as vice president, has already been meeting with Iraqis and promising very big deals for U.S. oil companies. But there's a key element here that has not been discussed, which requires far greater attention and may turn out to be more significant than oil itself, and may actually be one of the keys to unlocking this mystery of this obsessive sugar plums dancing in the head, a drive to go have that war, regardless of the enormous potential consequences for destabilization of the region and the entire world. And what is that issue? It is the dollar price for oil. Something happened, by the way, on November 6, 2002, which none of us were paying any attention to. How could we? It was 2 days after we were confronting a coup d'etat called an election, and everybody was watching Broward County and this county, whatever, to see what was going on. On that day, Iraq switched its currency, its transaction standard, from the dollar to the euro. And only Radio Free Europe, which nobody, as far as I know, listens to, I don't even get it in the United States, only Radio Free Europe publicly voiced its alarm that this is a potential disaster which could destroy the U.S. economy. See, Iraq switched to the euro when the euro was worth only 80 cents. Today, the euro is worth $1.09. So that's 29 cents. Now, multiply that by tens of billions of euros. Iraq made a killing. As a matter of fact, as one expert recently said, he made out like a bandit with the euro, which has increased 70% against the dollar since 2002. Now, what is the danger in all this? And that perhaps gives us the clue to this insatiable drive for war. If the euro predominates and the dollar becomes weaker and the dollar is inflated, that simply accelerates. In other words, oil is the big player in currency markets. And if euro becomes stronger because this is the standard of currency, and if Iraq, with the second proven reserves, sparks a movement throughout the Middle East to switch to the euro, the dollar becomes dramatically weakened and inflated. When that happens, capital stocks, which are driven by foreign deposits within the United States, which, by the way, is a big problem for China, which we'll talk about tomorrow, because China, with its massive export economy, is forced to keep the dollar up by holding its dollars payments within the United States. So the Chinese people are not getting much benefit out of this massive, you know, Chinese export economy. But you look at the oil and you have a similar situation. One expert actually, and nobody's paying much attention to this, pointed out that if Iran, which may be the next target for euro conversion, because the Iranians have been making noises that they like the euro and they will start accepting only euro deposits for their oil, if that happens, then there's a lament, really. And remember, the first Gulf War was largely driven by the fear that the Saudis would go to the Deutschmark. This is before the euro. That's another thing that people weren't paying much attention to. As far as the United States is concerned, then, this potential switch to European currency is the greatest nightmare, that all of OPEC could eventually switch its international transactions from the dollar to the euro standard. That, of course, would bring a sharp decline in the need for dollars, which are already feeling the strain of the U.S. recession. Reserve funds placed in U.S. banks by foreign capital would simply flee the U.S. The worst case scenario, the worst case, is that the United States could, and I think this is a terrible exaggeration, but this is the way some of these futurists are thinking, that the United States could go the way of Argentina, that the inflation could get so out of control, the weakening of the dollar could be so terrible. Now, if that is the kind of discussion that's going on in those inner circles, we have to try to figure out ways of smoking it out and dealing with it. Finally, and I think this is one of the most painful and difficult things to consider, there's this statement by the shrewd little old guy, Tariq Aziz, who is more Western-oriented, Iraqi vice minister, who said, this is not even about regime change. This is about region change. Well, what is this underlying motive of regime change, or as Aziz says, region change? It's actually ill-concealed. And it's been widely reported in the media all over the world. Influential right-wing ideologists in key positions have been working overtime to assure that the overthrow of Saddam Hussein is only the first step in transforming the entire region into a reservoir of U.S. interests, which of course would incorporate Sharon's interests. The Israeli newspaper, Yediot Ahronot, the Boston Globe, and many other sources report that a RAND study, RAND Institute in California, the Pentagon Senior Advisory Group, headed by Richard Perle, a little-known right-wing outfit called JINSA, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, tied to AIPAC, the Project for the New American Century, which we've already talked about, involving people like Douglas Feist, Richard Perle, Wolfowitz, Bolton, Rumsfeld, Cheney, etc., perceive, and this is spelled out with great clarity, perceive Iraq as what they call a tactical pivot, Saudi Arabia as a strategic pivot, and Egypt as, quote, the big prize. Egypt, mind you, perhaps the wealthiest in many respects, not wealthy in terms of oil, but wealthy in terms of development and advanced culture, etc. What these people are saying through the Pentagon Group, through RAND, and through the others, is that they would want to reconfigure the entire Middle East, starting with the overthrow of Saddam, then transform Saudi Arabia into what they call a Western-style free market democracy, spreading U.S.-style parliamentary rule, including U.S. military, strategic, and economic interests, into Iran, and from Iran to Egypt, getting rid of Mubarak, whom they don't like because Mubarak is not competent enough to crush the fundamentalists who are a growing force within Egypt, forcing Syria out of Lebanon, and there have been, and this is totally fanciful, but we have to put it on the record, talking about reconfiguring the old Hashemite kingdom of Jordan by slicing off a portion of Iraq and therefore affecting the final transfer of Palestinians from the West Bank to a so-called new Jordanian Hashemite Palestinian state. Well, this is totally bizarre, of course. And nevertheless, however, it is designed at nothing less than explaining a fevered, unquenchable desire to use military force in the region. For after all, think about it. When you stop and realize that these people think that they could do this in a short time, that they could control the consequences, that they could rally the American public behind them, largely by not showing photographs and moving pictures on television of the human cost of all this, that this absolutely maniacal belief in the power of the United States military and its strategic aim, its project for the 21st century of such a magnitude that it somehow could roll back fundamentalism through force, mind you, and bring democracy to the Middle East. When you throw in the dollar price for oil, when you throw in the whole question really of regime change to reconfigure a region to make it more amenable, you know, as a clone, so to speak, of the United States, you really, and you recognize the 150 to 200,000 military forces and the vast accumulation of advanced equipment, much of it advanced way over what they had in 1991. The situation is absolutely daunting. And yes, there are some figures on the left who, when you raise the question of perhaps stopping this, they look at you as if you are a naive, a middle grade fool at best. I had one of the top authorities on issues of peace and strategic issues regarding war and peace say to me just a week ago, I asked him, I said, what are the chances of war? And he says, well, on my good days, 98%. That's a good day. On an ordinary day, which is not a good day, 100%. On a trip to Vietnam, we had a very highly, highly respected, well-known writer on the left who said to me, there's going to be a war. There's just going to be a war. It's unstoppable. Well, I don't think it's unstoppable, although the odds, of course, are heavily, heavily against it. But first of all, there is a global anti-war movement, the like of which we have not seen in many, many years. Secondly, there's an important division, a fissure, a split, if you will, in the ruling elite, which is going to grow and not diminish as the pressures of this worldwide movement and the growth of a new vibrant political majority in this country accelerates, including many, many, many people who, for the first time in their lives, will be demonstrating, will be expressing themselves publicly in opposition to the war. That split already showing when a guy like General Schwarzkopf, who led the battle, you know, in 1991 as opposed to this war, Brent Scowcroft, and all the, you know, the old Reagan crowd, Bush senior crowd, strategists and policy wonks and the like are opposed to the war. Next, the allies, so-called, NATO, the European Union, China, they are not moving. What happened yesterday at the UN was critically important because it shows that France, being led by a conservative government, pressured by its own people and by its own strategic interest of not wanting to be boxed in and controlled by Washington, is standing firm thus far. And that is a very important factor. And yes, we have to add the behavior thus far, grudging perhaps, of a regime which is ugly, which must be replaced, but replaced by the will of the Iraqi people themselves, without outside interference, but nevertheless a regime which for its own survival has shown a considerable amount of flexibility and political acumen in dealing with the inspections, that also is helping us. I think it's heading in the right direction, although the odds are very, very seriously against us. So what do we do? One, let us not be afraid to talk to people that we have never talked to before. They are willing to listen, and they are willing to respond. And quite often, all they need is an encouraging word from a neighbor, a friend, an acquaintance, to set them off into active engagement, whether it be sending a phone call or a message or whatever to their elected official. Next, we need to do something we did not do at the end of the Vietnam War, we did not do at the end of the Gulf War, namely, not just narrowly to focus upon the war itself, but to focus, first of all, on the enormous damage that this expenditure is causing, not only in inflaming the threat of global war, but of intensifying the war upon the poor, upon the most vulnerable sectors of American society. A disgrace that this administration is not only wrecking the environment, tearing up medical aid, forcing the elderly, forcing them into crooked HMOs, you know, to benefit the insurance companies and the HMOs themselves. When you have this kind of factor, you have to constantly link these issues in a manner that will only deepen the determination of people to put an end to this. And finally, on an international scale, it is not enough to simply hope that we can stop a war in Iraq. We have to intensify this movement to get rid of all weapons of mass destruction in the first place, the nuclear arsenals held by the great powers. And that cannot be lost, and that is not a narrowing issue, that is a broadening issue. And of course, I think the final point would be 2004. I think it is vitally important for the progressive forces in this country, politically, electorally, to get their act together. We have to find a way of a relatively, I don't expect an absolutely united strategy, but a relatively united strategy. And we can't wait until the summer of 2004. I don't think this is a time for pessimism. There is much, much to be optimistic about. Look around you, participate, and peace will win. Thank you very much.